Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are a few people whose command of the intelligence, I guess in a way, but certainly bringing to bear great intelligence on one of the most important fronts of that war in Asia is our friend and colleague Gordon Chang. He graces us each week with his thoughts on what's developing, and it could hardly be more timely this week as President Trump is about to head that way. Gordon, of course, is a columnist for The Daily Beast. He contributes actively through Fox and other outlets as well. He is also the author of two best-selling books, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. Gordon, it's so good to have you. Welcome back.
Thank you so much, Frank.
The president is off to China. There are five nations on his itinerary. Tell us what you would expect he's likely to confront, and remind us where.
Yeah, the issue is going to be North Korea throughout this trip. And of course, that comes front and center when he goes to China, the third stop. You know, there's going to be some, I think, difficult discussions with Xi Jinping. Xi Jinping is just fresh off of the Communist Party's 19th National Congress, where he appears to have consolidated power. And I suspect that President Trump is going to say to the Chinese ruler, now that you're the big boss, there's no excuse for you. You've got to help the United States.
Well, help the United States is one piece of it. And the Chinese, as we've talked about most weeks, Gordon, are not necessarily disposed to do that. But the question is, I guess, either do they see it in their own interest to prevent North Korea's further metastasizing as a cancer in the region, or do they sense that the costs of doing otherwise will be intolerable as far as their relationship with the United States is concerned?
Yeah, if the Chinese were left to their own devices, they would be supporting North Korea to the hilt. And certainly they've been weaponizing the North. President Trump can change that calculus and has already started that process. You know, we have seen that with the meeting at early April in Mar-a-Lago with Xi Jinping. And since that time, there was at least a few months of honeymoon. But since that, President Trump has realized that the Chinese have been foot dragging and has actually started to impose costs on China for not being helpful on North Korea. This is where I think that President Trump really starts to have these honest conversations with Xi Jinping, because as pointed out, Trump is in no mood to tolerate Chinese support of the Kim Jong-un regime. And the other stops on this trip are important as well, but they're also North Korea related, because President Trump really has only one foreign policy goal these days, and that is to disarm the North Koreans.
And those would be where? Japan, South Korea, where else?
The Philippines and Vietnam. In Japan, he's going to meet Shinzo Abe, who has also just consolidated his position after snap elections, where the Liberal Democratic Party and its coalition partner have an overwhelming majority in both houses of the Diet. This is good news for the United States, because Abe wants to help the U.S. And indeed, if you look at the longer frame, going back over decades, the Japanese have been much more resolute on North Korea. And we should have been listening to Tokyo much more than we have. So I hope that President Trump goes into listening mode when he starts his trip in Tokyo, because the Japanese have got this right. And over the course of time, we've gotten it wrong.
Gordon, let me talk a little bit further with you about North Korea and what we're facing there at the moment. There are reports that the Chinese broke up a plot by the North Korean government to assassinate yet another of Kim Jong-un's relatives, apparently a nephew, in Beijing itself. I don't know if you know much about this story at this point or can comment on how likely it is that's true, but it does seem as though things are ratcheting up with respect to the North Korean government's concerns about its hold on power.
We shouldn't be surprised by these reports. Kim Jong-un, the ruler, has assassinated his elder half-brother, Kim Jong-nam, who was under the protection of China. The assassination occurred off Chinese soil. It just means that now the North Koreans, if these reports are true, have become much more bold.
It has to be another affront to the Chinese, though, that this might be going down in their capital city, no less. Also Korea-related, we had Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis literally at the DMZ and elsewhere in South Korea last week in sort of advance of the president's travels. He was sounding fairly forceful, I think it's fair to say, about what would befall the North Koreans if they were to engage in acts of aggression against us or our allies. Was there anything new there, at least with respect to steps that have been taken by the Trump administration to sort of begin backing up what's behind that rhetoric?
Mattis didn't say anything new. He said that the United States wanted to solve this diplomatically, but that there were military options on the table. What is new is that there are now three carriers under the command of Seventh Fleet. The Ronald Reagan is always there, but the Nimitz has been chopped over from Fifth Fleet, and the Theodore Roosevelt, called the Big Stick, was chopped over from Third. We have not had three carriers operate together in coordinated exercises since 2007. Certainly, this is the message to the North Koreans and to the Chinese. So Mattis didn't have to say anything new. The people in the region know what's happening because they see a buildup of U.S. assets in the region close to North Korea.
There have also been reports, Gordon, that the Trump administration has begun steps to restore, I believe, to strip alert, or at least very short alerts, the nuclear bomber force to a level that has not been seen since Cold War days. That, coupled with the statements that have been coming out of the administration, notably from the vice president, that the government of the United States seems determined to restore the credibility of our nuclear deterrent, is presumably also part of the messaging to the Korean government in Pyongyang. How do you think this is being received there?
I think that both the Chinese and the North Koreans understand that the U.S. is marshaling assets. And of course, this is a message to East Asia, but it's also a message to Putin, because Putin has been engaging in threats to use nuclear weapons in an offensive way. So it's about time that we showed that we are willing to back up our rhetoric with our strategic assets.
Gordon, let me ask you one other final question. Going back to Xi Jinping, when we last talked in the midst of, I think, or certainly in advance of the Party Congress, you were still speculating that Xi may not have full control. There are restive forces within the party and certainly within China. You've just said that it looks as though he has consolidated power, notably by failing, I think for the first time, to fail to designate an obvious successor among the party leadership. Would you just talk about that briefly?
Well, it's become a norm in the Communist Party for a successor to be designated midterm during the rule of a general secretary. We looked at the lineup of the Politburo Standing Committee, and there's no obvious successor there. They're much too old. And so the thought is that Xi Jinping is looking for an unprecedented third term as general secretary. And if you look at his work report, that 3-hour, 23-minute speech that he delivered two Wednesdays ago, you know, there's at least some hints that he wants five-year terms, because he talks about goals of 2035, and it sounds as if he wants to be around to realize those. So there is concern that this is going to be not just a three-term general secretary, but perhaps somebody lasting a lot longer. Now, I don't think he'll make it, largely because he's made himself chairman of everything as his adversaries deride him. And that means he's responsible for everything. And when things go well for Beijing, that's okay. But there are a number of indications that things aren't going to go so well, especially with the debt crisis. And so, therefore, he's going to be blamed for them by adversaries who are just waiting for him to make a misstep. So this is going to be, I think, a much shorter rule than most people at the time think. But clearly, he did consolidate his position.
We'll be watching it closely, as I know will you. Gordon, thank you so much for your time today, as well as your expertise. One of the high points of our program, we're always delighted to have you with us. Next up, we'll have an extended conversation with Claire Lopez, Vice President for Research and Analysis at the Center for Security Policy, on Iran, on the latest developments in the region there, as well as closer to home, Port Canaveral, specifically. That and more, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Claire Lopez, the Vice President for Research and Analysis at the Center for Security Policy. She has been working with us closely for years and extraordinarily productively, I'm happy to say, on many different counts, including overseeing the production of a series of monographs and occasional papers that are extraordinarily valuable, I think, as contributions to the public policy debate about the Muslim Brotherhood, the counter-jihad, the civilization jihad of the Muslim Brotherhood, and much, much more. We're going to talk about an upcoming product of that pipeline shortly, but check out all of these extremely interesting, informative, often provocative products at securefreedom.org. Claire Lopez, before coming to the center, has had a very distinguished record of service to our country, notably as a clandestine service officer in the Central Intelligence Agency for some 20 years. Since she left the agency, she has been involved with many of the most important projects of our time, including the effort to get to the bottom of what was going on with the Benghazi scandal. She is an extraordinary resource and a great guest. We're always delighted to have her with us. Claire, welcome back.
Well, thank you very much, Frank. Always glad to be with you, too.
Let me ask you, Claire, to talk a little bit, based in part on your background in intelligence, though all of the information that we'll discuss, I'm sure, is in the open sources, but there is this coming storm, it certainly sounds like, on the 4th of November, brought to us by something called Refuse Fascism. Tell us what these characters are claiming they will be doing on that occasion, and presumably thereafter, who they are and who they are working with.
Well, Refuse Fascism, Frank, is one of the groups and one of the largest of the groups that comprise what we've started to call Antifa. Antifa, of course, is short for anti-fascism, and literally began back in the last century, in the 20s and 30s in Europe, especially in Germany and Italy and Spain, as communists faced off in the street against Nazis. But this is an echo of that. So the modern echo of Antifa, or anti-fascist action, perhaps, is what we're seeing play out on the streets of the United States and our campuses really since the middle, I would say, of the presidential campaign in 2015-16. And now what we're seeing are various of its groups really taking a hard anarchist position. Refuse Fascism is one of the biggest of those groups. It formed in late 2016 in New York City, and its openly stated goal is to drive out the Trump and Pence fascist regime. It's openly supportive of Kim Jong-un's regime in North Korea, and it is the one, Refuse Fascism, the group that is really leading this event on November the 4th. That is a Saturday, the Saturday before this election season at the local level. And so they have published a map at their website, which, by the way, is refusefascism.org. And they very helpfully publish a map of the places they intend to hit on that day. They say take to the streets and public squares. Until our demand is met, the nightmare must end, the Trump-Pence regime must go. Interestingly, Virginia and Washington, D.C., and Maryland, that is the greater D.C. metro area, is not on the map, is not apparently targeted.
Which, well, may or may not mean that it's targeted, but it certainly isn't being telegraphed. Now, Claire Lopez, let me just make clear, I understand what you're saying. This is a revolutionary enterprise that has in mind explicitly violent activities aimed at the overthrow of our government. Is that correct?
That is exactly what it is. These are anarchists. Their roots are frankly and openly communist, Marxist-Leninist communist, taking pages out of the Saul Alinsky handbook, Rules for Radicals, to bring chaos to our streets, certainly to our campuses, and with the idea not only of taking aim at a particular then-candidate, now President Trump, or even political party, but rather to bring down the system itself, the Constitution, our system of law and order. That is their target, and they want to do that by causing enough chaos and strife in the streets that there will be a collapse of civil order. We, of course, don't expect that to happen. Law enforcement is very much aware of what is being planned, but nevertheless, that is their idea.
But Claire Lopez, it's my understanding that there are statutes on the books that make it illegal even to simply conspire to create rioting across interstate lines. It isn't something you have to wait for them actually to do. Is there any evidence that the authorities, if they're fully informed of this threat, are taking steps to prevent it from running its course on the 4th of November?
It's hard to know. Of course, as we know, the Department of Homeland Security, which along with local law enforcement should have the lead in encountering something like this, is in the midst of a transition change for its, you know, secretary of Homeland Security. The organization itself does not seem terribly well prepared, and we're simply hoping that local law enforcement is as prepared as they can possibly be for what's coming on November the 4th.
Well, as they say, hope is not a strategy, so this is ominous indeed, especially, Claire Lopez, against the backdrop of a new book that is being released today by Ed Klein, a former editor-in-chief of the New York Times Magazine and multiple best-selling author. His latest book is called All Out War, The Plot to Destroy Trump. And it apparently has evidence that has fallen into the hands of the FBI that this group, Antifa, has been not only working with various communists and North Korean and other hard left factions, but also with foreign terrorists of the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. This is an informational report, a confidential document that apparently has been sent to FBI field offices. Again, one would think that this would be precipitating the most aggressive action on the part of the authorities to put these guys out of business. What's going on?
The book by Ed Klein, and this book soon to be out, as a matter of fact, I guess maybe today, which is Monday, October the 30th, 2017, called All Out War, The Plot to Destroy Trump, refers to some of these anarchist groups in the United States having traveled to Germany at the time of the G20 summit last July, 2016, to meet with allegedly Al-Qaeda and Islamic State leaders and there to plot the destruction of President Trump. The FBI definitely is aware of this, is on it. One thing about these groups is that aside from the websites, there is no particular bricks and mortar headquarters. There is no office location. There may be leadership figures, and they certainly ought to focus on those as they are known. Part of the way these groups operate, these anarchist leftist groups, is in a kind of a diffuse way. They communicate on social media. They arrange and organize their events on social media. Sites go down, sites pop up. It's a little hard to actually get a handle on them.
Yeah, we hope that a handle is being gotten on them. You say the FBI is on the case. There better be evidence of that before all hell breaks loose on the 4th of November, if in fact that's what these guys are going to be able to pull off. Claire, we have to pause for just a moment. We'll be right back with more with Claire Lopez, including on another chilling development that may well affect vital national security interests. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by Claire Lopez. She is the Vice President for Research and Analysis at the Center for Security Policy. I was singing her praises a moment ago, in particular in connection with her role as the editor of the extraordinary products of the Center for Security Policy Press. And among the latest of them, in fact, it is not quite out yet, we expect it to be shortly, is a new occasional paper that addresses a topic that was first discussed in a similar product about a year ago, almost a year ago. Claire, tell us a bit about what is going on at Port Canaveral and what this occasional paper lays out and who the authors of it are.
Well, Port Canaveral, Frank, is an incredibly strategic location along Florida's Atlantic coast. It is very near to the Kennedy Space Launch Center and multiple military bases, naval bases along that coastline there. Last December, on the 22nd of December 2016, the center published an occasional paper by researchers Mary Fanning and Alan Jones. And that paper was called What Could Possibly Go Wrong? And it detailed the letting of a 35-year lease for the container facility at Port Canaveral, Florida, to a company called Gulftainer, which is jointly owned by Saddam Hussein's nuclear weapons mastermind, Dr. Jafar Jia Jafar, and a United Arab Emirates emir in the Emirate of Sharjah. Joint ownership of this company called Gulftainer, the family of Saddam Hussein's nuclear weapons mastermind. That's what the December 2016 paper was about. We now have new information and a new paper shortly to be out. At the center of all of this, of course, is the organization we know as CFIUS, and that is the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S., CFIUS for short.
An organization that has been much in the news of late in connection with the so-called Uranium One deal, and we will come back to that hopefully before the end of this conversation with Claire Lopez. But this organization, CFIUS, Claire, is supposed to protect vital national security equities when companies or foreign individuals are trying to acquire or otherwise take positions in them that could be problematic. That would certainly seem to be the case with Saddam's bomb maker, for crying out loud. And yet, what did CFIUS do in this regard?
So this committee, CFIUS, includes among its members representatives of all the U.S. government agencies one would expect, like Department of Commerce and Department of Transportation, the intelligence community, or at least formerly the intelligence community, Department of State, and so on. But of note, it also has a core sort of permanent staff. And unfortunately, the former CFIUS staff chair, one Nabi Ayman Mir, is the son of a Kashmiri-born physician who is directly connected to the Pakistani intelligence service. And this CFIUS staff chair, Ayman Mir, also was connected as the two-time president of the youth wing of the Islamic Society of North America, that is one of the largest Muslim Brotherhood front groups in the country.
My God, Claire Lopez, tell me, when was this individual in place, and would his role have enabled him to have influence, not just perhaps on this transaction involving Gulftainer and Port Canaveral, but also Uranium One and heavens knows what all else?
Yes. So this Ayman Nabi Mir, with connections to Pakistani intelligence and the U.S. Muslim Brotherhood, served as the staff chair, that is a permanent member of CFIUS, from 2009 until 2014, period of 5 years, during which incredibly important matters came before the CFIUS, including the Uranium One deal and the CFIUS decision to approve the sale of Uranium One to Russia's Rosatom company, government-affiliated company, and then, of course, this deal about the Gulftainer cargo terminal lease at Port Canaveral.
Claire, this is unbelievably troubling, and just when you thought it couldn't get worse than having the Secretary of State apparently selling out the country with respect to uranium stocks for an immense amount of money funneled to her and her family through her foundation or directly, in the case of Bill Clinton, apparently a fabulously overpaid speech. But to have the permanent, you know, staff person on this this national security vetting organization have the kind of credentials that you've just described is extraordinarily shocking. And I hope will cause a fresh look, quite apart from the Uranium One caper, to be applied to CFIUS and what needs to be done to enhance its performance. For starters, vetting closely the people involved in it, I think, is obvious. Claire, one other aspect of this transaction with Gulftainer was called to my attention by you recently. I think our researchers, Alan Jones and Mary Fanning, discovered that there is something else that may be problematic about the container company that is supposed to manage the port for the next 35 years. Tell us about that.
Yes. So this Cracker Jack investigative team of Mary Fanning and Alan Jones published a preview of the longer paper that the center is going to publish later this week. And it is called Obama Appointed Islamic Society Official to Approve Russian Uranium Sale and Gulftainer Port Deal. That is what we were just talking about. But in addition, what they uncovered and what will be forthcoming in this paper soon to be published is that Gulftainer, the company that got that Port Canaveral container facility lease, is involved in a joint venture with the Russian state-owned company called Rostec, which itself owns 100% of the shares of the company that exports the Club K container missile launch system. This is the system that looks like an ordinary shipping container, the ones you see piled on the decks of ships all over the world. But in this one, the Club K, the top pops off in order to allow missiles inside to rise up and to launch. Cruise missiles are what are contained inside of the Club K car, and they can hold either nuclear or conventional payloads, but also biological, chemical, or even an EMP payload.
So, Claire Lopez, these are missiles that could be brought very close to our shores, or for that matter, actually into one of our main ports on the coast of Florida, by a company that has a joint venture with the manufacturers of these things in Russia. There is evidence, as I understand it, that these things are not only inherently nuclear capable, but that this bomb maker in Iraq had actually devised a weapon that would go aboard them. Is that right? And if so, what kinds of threat does this capability represent to a country like ours that has turned over the management of this facility to that same company, Gulftainer?
Well, the family of Saddam Hussein's nuclear weapons mastermind, again, is the one, the family that owns Gulftainer, that got this deal, the Jafar family. Dr. Jafar, Dia Jafar, is the name of that nuclear weapons mastermind for Saddam Hussein. And the details that Mary Fanning and Alan Jones have uncovered include the fact that Dr. Jafar actually succeeded in designing a miniaturized nuclear weapon called the beach ball for its shape and its size. Not that it was ever necessarily produced or deployed, but that it was designed, and the design documents, the blueprints, have apparently been discovered.
And that it was configured to go on this Club K cruise missile. Claire, we have to pause at this point. We will be right back with more, and we'll talk a bit about another of the bad actors that Claire Lopez is following closely, the Islamic Republic of Iran. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are visiting with Claire Lopez. I'm very pleased to say we've had an opportunity for an extended conversation with her. There's always a lot to talk about and often too little time. So, Claire, thank you for generously giving of your time. We've got so much more that could be said about that business with Iraq's bomb maker and the problems with the Port Canaveral facility. But I do want to press you to talk a little bit about Iran as well. We have had, I think since our last visit, a decision by President Trump with respect to the nuclear deal with the Iranians that was fashioned by President Obama. Give us a sense of how this is working out, Claire, particularly at the strategic level, what Iran is up to and whether we're likely to see much worse to come.
As you mentioned there, Frank, a couple of weeks ago, President Trump finally did decline to recertify the Iran deal, the JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which means that he is saying it cannot be verified, the deal cannot be verified, that the Iranians are abiding by each of its provisions. This goes along with what the IAEA, that is the International Atomic Energy Agency, has declared as well, that it is unable to certify that Iran is in compliance with the JCPOA either. And so that does not mean that the United States has literally pulled out of the deal. Although the president has the authority to do that, he did not take that step, at least yet, but rather sort of tossed the ball back into Congress's court, giving Congress 60 days to come up with, I guess, improvements to the nuclear deal. So there it sits at the moment. In the meantime, things do not sit or stand still for Iran and in the Middle East, but rather a flurry of pronouncements has come out of the Iranian leadership declaring that it will keep on producing ballistic missiles. Well, neither here nor there. That's not in the JCPOA. But also moving on the ground militarily across the region of what used to be called Iraq and Syria, taking ground as the Islamic State is pushed out and pushed back.
With our help, to be sure, and this is a fine point that I think is lost on many of us, Claire Lopez, but you understand very, very well the role being played these days by Iran in Iraq. Talk, if you would, about how this rolling up of the Islamic State has been taking place. Whose boots are on the ground, in short, I guess, in this effort to liberate first Mosul and now Raqqa and otherwise defeat the Islamic State? And who's providing air support for them?
So there are two major battle fronts, if you will, one the former Iraq, one the former Syria, going on in the fight to defeat the Islamic State. And indeed, it has lost a great deal of the territory it used to hold. In the former Iraq, it is the Baghdad regime, which many would consider to be a proxy or a puppet of the mullah's regime in Tehran. It is Baghdad that has taken the lead in fighting against the Islamic State, but with the strong support, not so much of Iranian forces per se, but rather of its proxy militias, Shiite militias that go by the name of Hashd al-Shaabi, or sometimes also called paramilitary popular mobilization units, or PMUs. And these units are Shiites, not just Iraqi, but also recruits that the Iranians brought in from places as far as Afghanistan and Pakistan to fight. So it is these units pushing back the Islamic State, for the most part, together with the Iraqi army inside of the former Iraq, and all of that mostly under the command of Iran's Quds Force commander, Major General Qasem Soleimani.
Who's a very bad actor indeed. To what extent has the Peshmerga, the Kurdish military sort of organization, been a player in Iraq as well as in the campaign against Syrian-based Islamic State, I should say?
Well, the Kurds have formed many years since, and with United States and Western support and protection, an area called the Kurdish Regional Government, or Kurdistan, up in the northern part of what used to be called Iraq. And it has been largely an oasis, separated for all of these years from what is the chaos going on in the rest of the area until now recently, with the advance of the Islamic State and the Kurdish Peshmerga, in particular the Kurds belonging to Masoud Barzani's KDP, Kurdish Democratic Forces. They did the brunt of the fighting, while also the rival Kurds, and this is part of the problem, they are not united. They're terribly factionalized among themselves. Jalal Talabani's PUK, or Patriotic Union of Kurdistan Forces, Jalal Talabani, of course, just died about 1 month ago. They took the brunt, the overall Kurds took the brunt of a lot of the fighting that pushed back the Islamic State. But as I said, now moving in its place, as it recedes, are Shiites. They are even being transplanted, if you will, in a population exchange to put Shiites into areas that formerly were Sunni Arab. This is a problem that's not going away.
Aversion, I guess it's not ethnic cleansing so much as sectarian cleansing, but very much inimical to the kind of populations that were previously components of Iraq. And this is why you keep referring to it as the place formerly known as Iraq. We are also watching those same popular mobilization units now being put into areas that have been under the control of the Peshmerga and the Kurds. Claire Lopez, this is, to my way of thinking, been a very black day for the United States and others who have recognized in the past, at least, that the Kurds are natural allies of ours, or at least friends, and we have abandoned them. Tell us a little bit about the implications of that for the region, Claire Lopez, and for our interests there, including the protection of Christians, quite a number of whom had found refuge in that safe haven.
Yeah, I really have to agree that it was a black day just about a week ago. That would be towards the end of October 2017 here, that the Shiite forces and Iraqi forces under command, really, of Qasem Soleimani, Quds Force again, moved on Kirkuk. Kirkuk is the heartland of the Kurdish people. It is the center of a very rich oil-producing region as well. The city lies just outside of the territory or boundaries of the Kurdish Democratic Region, but nevertheless, the forces moved on it about a week ago. The United States stood back. We have been helping and backing and defending and arming and training the Kurds for decades, beginning against Saddam Hussein. And we abandoned them when they were in their worst peril. Qasem Soleimani apparently conducted some sort of behind-the-scenes treachery, as I said, between these factionalized groups of Kurds, talking with the PUK, Talabani's people, to stand down and let his forces advance into Kirkuk, while the forces of Masoud Barzani, the KDP, did fight. Some of them fought hard but ran out of ammunition and had to fall back. Kirkuk fell. Kirkuk fell. We allowed that to happen to the forces of Baghdad and the Shiite militias.
Yeah, and their Iranian sponsors, needless to say. Claire Lopez, we have to leave it at that, I'm sorry to say, for the moment, but I know we will be following it closely at the Center for Security Policy with your extraordinarily able help. And we'll look forward to further updates from you as this progresses. But in the meantime, I think it's fair to say the Iranians are emboldened by all that has been transpiring. And there will be more of these threats, nuclear and otherwise, coming from that quarter. That's it for today. Thank you, Claire. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.